Hello, this is Patrick Newman from usabilitycounts.com. This is our fourth podcast. On today, we have Mark Danziger. Mark is a technology and business strategy consultant in the last 20 years, and one of the areas he's been focused on, particularly lately, is social media. So, Mark, go ahead and tell me more about your background.
Well, I mean, I think the short version is that I started out as sort of, like many people, a self-taught coder. And because I'd had a fair amount of business experience when I started doing that, I discovered that I was actually more valuable as sort of a liaison between technology and management than I was as a pure technologist. And I spent a number of years basically as the sort of broker between the technology delivery people and the people that wanted stuff. And that sort of cycled between sort of what I call business architecture, i.e. what's the system supposed to do, business analysis and project management, and wound up as a fairly high-end corporate project manager specializing in broken projects because I sort of am one of these people who likes sort of anxiety and stress. It seems to make me more comfortable than not having it.
That's really, really important. I mean, as we have talked before, a lot of those projects, what it takes is somebody to come in and kind of grab people by the horns and get them in the right direction.
Well, and what happens is when you've got a lot of money on the table and things are going badly, people tend to get anxious and stupid. And it's very difficult to do good creative work when people are being anxious and stupid. And
yeah.
So you have to sort of get people calmed down. And it's interesting because, I mean, that practice is what sort of led me indirectly to social media. I'd been a social media user. I had a Well account. I managed for fun the message boards for the Atlantic Magazine on AOL, back when it was on AOL, when AOL was, the thing. And I'd just been a fan, of doing that stuff. I'd enjoyed it. And as I got more and more into the roots of both fixing kind of big, bad organizations and trying to think about how to prevent them from going bad, I sort of, started looking at agile development as a methodology and at sort of collaborative tools as a way of expressing the methodology and actually, empowering people to do stuff. And one day, the little light switch goes on in my head and I'm basically looking at my hobby, which is sort of the social media stuff, and I'm looking at my business, and I go, wait a minute, I see some synergy here. And I went off and through the company that I worked for at the time, convinced them to take me into their major corporate clients and start pitching sort of social media as a tool. This is about two and a half years ago. And we were, right at the cutting edge early of it, but we got a ton of interest and a ton of activity from big corporations, from Manpower, from Mansueto Digital, who is Inc. BizNet and Fast Company, from Florida Hospitals, which is a giant hospital chain in Florida, and some others. And, I think that what was fairly cutting edge then has become kind of mainstream, which I think is really a wonderful and cool thing.
Yeah, it definitely is. And one of the things, just for the audience out there, Mark runs a blog called charmedparticles.com. And one of the interesting posts he brought up a few days ago was quality as a community metric. And a lot of communities, one, they run into barriers of growth, and they also run into the issue of the quality of the conversation in that community or social media space. Social media network that Mark brought up was Yelp.
I started digging a little bit into sort of Yelp and some of the local kind of reference communities a while ago. And one of the things that sort of came up, I had an interesting email that came from actually a friend of my wife's where she said, I used to use Yelp a lot, but I hardly use it anymore because, I'm about finding sort of interesting restaurants and good places to kind of go out. And Yelp has become kind of a place for younger kids to go talk about which bars they got seriously drunk in and which bathrooms they can go hook up in. And I find that kind of off-putting.
When she was talking about that, was she talking about that in the message boards, Or was she?
It's actually in the reviews. I mean, if you go into Yelp and read reviews of, you know, kind of bars and clubs in Hollywood, you know, it's much more kind of narrative of my Friday night than it is, hey, this is a good bar or club because X, Y, Z.
Focusing on Yelp, that might only be localized like in certain areas, or is that across the board?
Well, Yelp tends to be, you know, present where you have kind of what I call the famous the Bobo, the bohemian bourgeois kind of community. And, you know, in New York, in Portland, in Seattle, in San Francisco, in L.A., in Chicago, in Atlanta, you know, Yelp tends to be used by, you know, people who, you know, can differentiate kinds of tattoos. And, you know, to a certain extent, that's their audience, but certain kinds of behavior may make it more attractive to part of the audience, but they also will drive away other parts of the audience. And so part of, I think, the overall point that I make a ton when I deal with, you know, community owners, right, the people that want to implement community tools, is to sit down and say, well, okay, who exactly is your audience? And when they tell me, well, our audience is everybody. It's everybody in the United States. You know, my response is always, no, it isn't. You know, there's nothing that reaches everybody in the United States. There's nothing that is likely to ever reach everybody in the United States. So you have to really think about who you're trying to attract. You know, just like if I opened a restaurant, which is the metaphor I use a ton, you know, every restaurant is for somebody, right? There is a theme. There is a reason. There's a reason why I would choose to go to Carl's Jr., and there's a reason why I would choose to go to Le Cirque in New York. And, you know, you need to be able to know and articulate what that reason is and who your community you're trying to attract is. Because to be honest, when they walk in the door, you know, it's like the tone is set, which establishes people's interest in their behavior. And so if they walk in the door and a guy with piercings and spiked green hair, you know, takes a stein of beer, throws it, you know, into the fireplace and smashes it and, you know, hands them a shot glass and a stein of beer, that's one kind of place they've walked into. And if they walk in the door and a, you know, waiter in a tuxedo with a, you know, napkin over his arm and a silver tray of drinks, you know, reaches out with the tray and hands a flute of champagne, that's another kind of place. So
along that same conversation, basically, so for the first, to establish that, how do we get a quality social community, you almost have to define what you mean by that quality social community.
That's right. Well, and I think there's a couple of things. I mean, one is that the community is doing what it's intended to do, right? And if you look at the numbers, most private enterprise-sponsored communities fail. You know, the last number I saw said that between 75 and 80% of the community efforts launched by corporate, you know, entities, you know, were failures, i.e. they didn't generate traffic or they had to be closed down. And the reason they fail, I mean, there's a bunch of reasons, but is either they don't attract any activity at all, or they attract the wrong kind of activity, and when they do get activity, it's the kind of activity that drives away the people that are really part of the community that's there for whatever the company is.
So for in that same vein, like we'll take your friend as an example, and she probably doesn't meet that demographic that is talking about getting drunk in the bar and everything. So for that matter, she might actually waltz on over to a different community like Chowhound or Urban Spoon, for example, and find that to be.
That's exactly right. Her email specifically said that she had moved over to using Chowhound now because, you know, because Yelp was basically, you know, not useful for her.
Yes. So basically, yeah, I'll go even one further than this. I mean, I'm going to venture a guess, and I've noticed this about Yelp too, as I've been to a few of the events, and I'm going to guess that the people that go to the events are like young, a little bit upscale, but, you know, they're a party group. I can tell. They probably match the people that actually manage Yelp as a community, as a corporation. So maybe that is their target audience, and maybe they're willing to tolerate a little bit of that for that community.
Well, but the problem is, you know, if you read their business, you know, I haven't read the Yelp business plan, but I don't think the Yelp business plan says we're here to be the premier community for people who want to go to bars on Friday night. You know, and so I think the issue becomes, how do you manage your community to make it, and I'm going to do, you know, scare quotes, right, successful, right? And successful means that the community does a couple things. One is that you, the person who's writing the checks for the community, have some intent in mind for it, right? So you want to build your brand, or you want to create a space where people share experiences, or whatever. And one of the things that I do with all my corporate clients is I make them sit down and tell me what the community is for, right? So it's not just something they read about in Wired magazine and they decided they had to get one, because that's most of the time what happens in you know, the world, but that they have a specific, we want to have a community because we are a company that sells specialized electronic hardware, and there's a community of engineers in the world who use our stuff religiously, and we want to make sure that those people know that they can talk to each other about how to use our stuff and that we can get suggestions from them on how to make our stuff better. Great. You know, that's a reason to have a community that where you can measure whether you're being successful or not. The other way you measure a community is by measuring the activity of the community, and that's pretty easy to quantify, and the problem is that most of the people in the social media advisory space have kind of bought off on the idea that activity is really where it's at. And so you measure how many unique visits did you get to the community. You measure how many of those unique visitors did you convert to being community members. You measure how many people did you convert to community members and how much did they post and how often. You measure the sentiment, positive or negative, of the posts they put up. You put together, you know, packages of information around the data that the servers give you to talk about the activity in the community, and the presumption is that if you have a high activity community, you have a successful community. Problem with that is twofold. One is, if you go back to the point of having a goal for the community, right, as the person who's writing the checks, if I'm a nonprofit, if I'm a corporation, if I'm a political party, right, I am paying for the server time. I am paying for the bandwidth. I'm paying for the labor of the people who put the community together and who operate it. I'm doing that to get something back, right? There's a reason why I'm putting that out there. And so the first question is, are you meeting those goals? Right? Does all that activity meet the goals of that you're trying to achieve? But there's the third leg of the stool, right, is what I call community quality. Right? And that's really not something that's easy to measure off of looking at server, you know, traffic logs. Community quality is really something that talks about two things. You know, the first thing is really whether the people in the community feel like they're part of a community. And that means, do they, you know, evangelize the community? Do they go out and encourage other people to come in and join the community? And secondly, do they themselves manage behavior within the community, right? Because one thing that happens in every online community is you have bad behavior, right? And every community has unique, it's like Tolstoy, right? Every family that's bad has, you know, different stories. But and so everyone has slightly different bad behavior, but the reality is that there's a couple of basic things that, you know, people are going to do. If you allow people to post, you know, video and pictures, people are going to, someone in your community is going to post inappropriate video and pictures. Right? They're just, you know, they're going to do it. Right? If whenever people are allowed to create user-generated content and write their own posts or comments, somebody is going to be abusive to other people. Somebody is going to make an outrageous, you know, racial, sexual, you know, violent comment towards somebody else. And the question now is, how are you going to, how does that get managed? Right? And it's, do we have cops? Do we have paid moderators, right, who patrol the community and deal with the crime? Or do the citizens of the community feel enough of a sense of ownership of that community that they themselves will engage the person and deal with it? And for me, the holy grail in these communities has always been when the users of the community are passionate enough to sell the community outward to other people and encourage them to come join because they think it's so great. And when they are willing to what I call upward norm the behavior, right? When they're willing to challenge somebody who's doing something bad and say, hey, you're damaging my community, at that point, they feel like they own it enough that they've got a stake in it and it matters to them. And you now have a real community.
So the communities out there, like the upward norming, I would venture to say that Wikipedia, for example, is one that upward norms really well.
Yep, absolutely. I think Wikipedia is one of the models.
Another one that upward norms pretty well is Facebook within people's own community because their real names are attached and people know they're not, you know, if they put fake stuff up or whatever, there's going to be some kind of consequence.
Well, because the interesting thing about Facebook is this cool intersection between the physical and the virtual worlds, right? Where, you know, most of the people who are Facebook friends of mine, I've shaken hands with. Not all of them, but, you know, I have a lot of Facebook friends. But I would be willing to venture that I've actually, you know, shaken hands or hugged or whatever, you know, 2/3 of the people that I'm friends with on Facebook. And as a consequence, if I behave like a real jackass, I'm doing it in front of people who I know in the real world and it has consequences for my real world life. And one of the things about the internet, you know, the classic Godwin's Law, Usenet sort of problem, is that in most places on the internet, the intersection between my virtual presence and my real world presence is very tenuous at best. And so I can do whatever I want in, you know, the virtual world, and, you know, it doesn't really matter in the physical world. There's a horrible story. There's a blogger named Mike Hendricks, who's kind of a rock and roll, punk, conservative, wild man who lives in the East Coast. And Mike's wife was killed in a motorcycle accident, riding with him. And some random guy came onto Mike's blog and commented, basically that, you know, in short, that he was glad she was dead because Mike obviously didn't deserve to have someone be married to him. Things got kind of challenging at that point, as you can imagine. And it turned out that, you know, the guy was outed. Somebody went and did the homework to connect his virtual persona to his real persona. At which point, the guy backed down, apologized, you know, did all the kind of behavior-appropriate things you'd hope somebody would do who said things like that. And the reason is only because it was tied to his physical persona. It had consequences in his daily life. And so for me, Facebook as a place where virtually everybody uses their real name, not 100%, but almost everybody, and where most of the people who I'm connected with are people who I know, is a very strong example of upward norming. There was just an article in Slate about Metafilter's Ask Metafilter community, and that talked about how incredibly, you know, benign, and that's really the wrong word, but what a hospitable place it was, and how, you know, bad behavior is aggressively challenged both by the paid and unpaid moderators, but by members of the community itself. And so there's very, very little of the normal, you know, kind of, I go there and I ask a question, and people are like, oh, you're so clueless, how could you even ask this question, you know, you don't deserve to live discussion, which you'll get on a lot of other communities because of that. And as a consequence, it's considered to be a fairly remarkable and successful place.
Yeah, well, LinkedIn is a little bit of that same approach because it's purely business, right?
I mean, imagine if you really flame somebody in LinkedIn. You know, I mean, it's going to have consequences in your professional life. And I think one of the things that I kind of like a little bit about the rise of global social media is, you know, the fact that people's behavior, you know, we live in big cities. We don't usually know our neighbors. We don't know a lot of the people around us. And so people tend to feel free to behave badly and to not think about what they do, as opposed to the classic, you know, I live in a small town and now I've got to, you know, deal with, you know, managing my stuff. But, you know, what social media does is social media brings to a certain extent the need to take care of your behavior, right, to, you know, the virtual world. and it brings it a little bit to the rest of our lives. There's the classic story about, I think it was called Dog Shit Girl in Korea, where this woman is on a train, a subway train in Korea with her pet dog, and the dog basically takes a dump in the middle of the train, and people ask her to clean it up, and she tells them to get stuffed. And there's all this video and photos, and it went up on blogs that night. And within 2 days, people had identified the woman, and she had to quit her job and write a public apology. And, you know, it was much more Asian, I think, in terms of how strongly she had to react. But I think that that's a good example of the fact that we do stuff now in public, and it sticks to us. And as a consequence, you know, it's kind of the Wild West right now. I mean, we talk about bad behavior and online, but I really do believe, and maybe I'm too optimistic, that I think people's behavior online is ultimately going to start changing, and I think it's going to have an effect on their behavior in the real world as well.
Because they realize the consequences that could result depending on how they behave.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's one thing to be a griefer and never have to interact with anybody and to be able to be totally anonymous and not have anyone know who you were. And that was really easy to do 4 or 5 years ago, right? It's really hard to do today. And when you look at pretty much all the cases of people who've done, you know, fairly outrageous stuff online, Debbie Frisch is a classic example, another commenter on a blog who went off and suggested that somebody's kid should get killed, you know, who ultimately kind of lost her job and had big chunks of her life fall apart as a consequence. You know, you start realizing that we have these kind of stories that tell us, well, you know, I need to start thinking about manners. And it kind of becomes, in a sense, you know, we need to go back and reread, you know, the classic Emily Post, you know, sort of manners books and think about, you know, kind of Dale Carnegie and how we functioned in sort of that world. And those things aren't necessarily terrible, in my view. I mean, I think that behaving with civility to each other is a really valuable skill.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine several years ago, and one of the things that we would talk about is we would see all these pictures from the 30s, for example, or the 20s, and everybody would be wearing the hat and the suit. And I think in some ways we've gotten away from that. We think it's okay for bad behavior. Maybe this is a way they encourage better behavior.
Well, I think it is. And I think again, going back to community rather than the global social consequences, I mean, within a community, the real question is, you know, what kind of behavior do you want? There are absolutely communities that you want to be, you know, brutal and you know, and sort of funny and abusive where, you know, if Jackass, you know, has a community, I assume they probably do, or if Tucker has a community, you know, and I'm probably sure he does, you know, people are going to be wild and crazy and out of control, and that's the right place to do it. The issue becomes, are there going to be communities where that's not the right place to do it? And so far, you know, if you look at what's happened when, like, newspapers have opened up to comments, you know, people say horrible, horrible things. And I think that you're going to start seeing that be a barrier. In fact, it is a barrier. I mean, I've got major corporate clients who will not do corporate-sponsored and funded communities because they're afraid of what people are going to say on their real estate. And, you know, that's a barrier that for some companies is never going to be overcome.
Well,
and so...
Yeah, I think part of it is also, like, if, for example, one of your clients opened up the community, and it's also a way of keeping companies honest. So if they open up the community, for example, you talk about the Dell example on your blog, and Jeff Jarvis kind of making a comment about the lack of quality of one of the products. I think a lot of companies are afraid of that discourse because they know they aren't providing the best level of quality, but part of that level is also a conscious business decision too.
But part of it is, you know, you have to be able to explain or justify that to the people that buy your stuff. I don't think Hyundai loses a lot of sleep explaining to its customers why it's not Mercedes-Benz or Bentley. you know, I think that, you know, to the extent that they're, you know, honest and forthcoming about who they are and what they're about, then I think, you know, everybody's going to be great with it. I think that to the extent that, you know, I'll tell a story. I was at a community conference a couple years ago, and somebody was there from WebEx. And they were talking about, you know, WebEx investing in community and putting together a community of users and blah, 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 blah. And some guy in back got up and sort of was kind of teed off and was going off about, well, you know, why don't you guys put the money into improving your damn service? And we're customers and we have all these problems and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I stood up and maybe I'd had a little too much caffeine that morning. And I said, wait a minute, you're out of line, right? And you're wrong, right? And I said, you're wrong because to the extent that they have a community, they're going to have to make changes in their service if they're really making a lot of customers unhappy. You know, and so by virtue of the fact that they're going to do this, that itself is going to make a change, which is going to force them to improve their service. So you should be applauding this. You shouldn't be criticizing it. And I really do kind of passionately believe that, A, you know, companies are going to have to do this. Whether they do it on their own real estate, i.e. they build and own a community of their own, or whether they participate in communities on other people's real estate like Yelp or like City Search, companies are going to have to begin to engage their customers and hear what the customers have to say, whether they like it or not. And I'm 100%, 1,000% about that, because I think that that's how we're going to wind up getting great companies in this country and how we're going to wind up building organizations that are ultimately going to be able to be successful. And again, to circle back, it comes back to this question of, can they build communities or participate in communities that are high quality as well as, you know, high energy? And that quality issue is one that I just don't see enough people talking about and that I would love to, you know, kind of inject into the discourse so that other folks were starting to consider it a little more.
Yeah, because if you talk about that quality issue, for example, I mean, a lot of the social media advantages of companies that do social media right, they are basically, instead of them just talking at their customers are having the conversation for them. And that's free marketing, as far as I'm concerned. And
well,
so
it's not like,
really, go ahead.
But it's, well, I mean, it's not only free marketing, it's a fundamentally different way of engaging the customer, right? On my blog, I have another little story, right, which is I talk about dating as a good metaphor for marketing. And I used to work with a guy a number of years ago who literally would ask out every reasonably attractive woman he saw in the course of his day. And this is a guy who had printed up business cards, like personal business cards and matchbooks. And if I went to lunch with this guy, he would give his card, he would stop, he would give his card, and he would ask, you know, five women to call him in the course of walking from our office to the restaurant. And sitting in the restaurant, he would give out five more, and walking back, he would give out five more. And it kind of worked for him. I mean, this is a guy who actually went out three or four nights a week. I mean, I was shocked that people would do this, because it certainly isn't anything that I've ever done. But it worked. And that's really how traditional advertising works. I mean, I get a flyer in my mailbox from a locksmith, and it's saying, buy my services, right? Or I run a banner ad on Facebook or on, you know, websites, and it says, you know, come out to dinner with me. It's fundamentally what we're saying. Now, the problem with that is it works great if there's one or two people doing it, right? And it's kind of unusual. And I actually watched these women respond to this guy, and they were kind of laughing, and it was sort of funny, and it was odd, and it was unusual. And that they were sort of charmed by it in a way because of that. Well, but if every guy in America or in Los Angeles did that, every woman would be getting asked out 100 times a day. And her reaction, I think, would probably be to buy a can of pepper spray. Right, and the problem is that if you look at advertising today, all of us get 1,000 ad impressions a day, right? Between junk mail and television and what we see online, and we don't even see them anymore, right? And
well,
so the only way, go ahead.
My impression of that is, you know, we don't see them anymore, But my impression is that, you know, what was I going to say? I just totally...
No, what winds up happening is that people just stop seeing it. They either buy pepper spray and they hate all advertisers, or they stop seeing it. And so what happens is, you know, the alternate approach, like I have two boys who are in their 20s, and I spent a lot of time talking to them when they were teenagers about dating. And it's, you know, they're anxious about it like we all were when we were, you know, 15 and 16. And I basically said, hey, you know, approach it like you're not really interested in the date, but like you're interested in the friend, and let the friendship develop into something more. And if you approach a customer as a human being with whom you share a common interest, if I'm a motorcycle dealer, you know, and you're remotely interested in motorcycles, we share a common interest. Or you might be interested in motorcycles. We share a common interest. And I have something you want. I have expertise. I have a depth of experience and information that you don't have. I can tell you about different things that you don't know about. But you also have experience that I don't know about. And to the extent that I enter into, and literally I have another blog post up where I talk about defining conversation as opposed to talking, right? Because you can talk a whole lot and not have a conversation, right? But what a conversation involves is respecting the other party. It's believing that the other party, first of all, owns their own words, that they didn't, you know, they're not regurgitating something that somebody told them to do, that they have something to say that's actually of interest to you, and that at the end of the day, right, you hope to learn as much from them as you hope they learn from you. And, you know, that's what conversations are all about. And when conversations are done, right, both parties to a conversation ultimately feel like they were heard. You know, and at the end of the day, what businesses are going to have to do, because we're raising a whole generation of people, my kids, right, grew up expecting to be heard. Right, not only because they had baby boomers for parents, but because, you know, they've been operating in a world where Facebook, where, you know, they could give feedback, where they could have dialogue with pretty much everybody they dealt with. And so businesses that don't do this, businesses that aren't willing, right, to listen to the customers and enter into what I call respectful dialogue with them, are going to have a really hard time getting customers. And so what you're going to start seeing is businesses that change their emphasis away from a handing 10 business cards out and asking every woman down the street, you know, to come out and have dinner with you, to finding one woman who basically, or guy, or, you know, whatever gender you are interested in, but finding that one person who is reading a book that you happen to be interested in, or who is wearing a piece of jewelry that you think is really cool, or who, you know, talks about going a place that you really want to go and are really interested in hearing about, and starting to talk to them. And you know, having those kind of conversations, and those conversations ultimately will lead to, you know, deeper relationships, which in the case of businesses hopefully will lead to people actually buying stuff from you. But it's the only way you're going to be able to get and maintain people's attention and trust. And ultimately, if you can't, you know, sell based on attention or trust, you got to be Walmart. You got to sell on, you know, we have more stuff than anybody else, and we sell it for half the price.
Yeah, and most companies can't scale to that. So in a lot of ways, doing, you know, basically the quality of social media, for example, a lot of it, it's marketing on a micro level. It's really that one-to-one person conversation. And for a lot of companies, the upfront cost will probably be higher to generate those leads and to acquire that customer. But in the long run, that's a better customer to have.
Well, but I think the upfront costs are going to be higher because it's a new pattern of behavior that you've got to learn as a business, right? But I think, you know, look at how much businesses spend today on advertising and marketing. You know, I mean, so look at that entire advertising budget and think about how much it really buys you.
Well, that was actually a conversation. A friend of mine, for example, runs a chiropractic business that it's so close to me I can actually see his building where he works at, right? And he really does work on that almost micro level for his business. And for him, he did the upfront cost of, okay, let's set up a website and let's do these other things, but he's actually working more with social media, like Yelp, for example, and actually shunning traditional media, like print publications, because he actually, just doing an analysis of where the leads are coming from and repeat customers are coming from, they're all coming from the web. And he wasn't getting anything from the traditional because it's just too hard to be heard.
Well, and that's, you know, the reality is that at some point, you know, you can clearly be heard in traditional media, but it's really expensive and hard, right? But companies are used to that expensive and hard. It's sort of like I'm used to my mortgage payment, right? I don't even really think about it that much. I just write the check.
Mm-hmm.
Businesses are used to that kind of expensive and hard. But the problem is it's getting more expensive and it's getting harder. And at some point, most businesses realize they hit the point of diminishing returns. And so the question becomes, particularly for non-Walmart businesses, right? For businesses like your buddy, you know, the average business in America who is, you know, not able to afford, you know, a real major ad campaign, who doesn't have an ad agency, how are they going to attract business? And, you know, and the answer becomes sort of doing a hard look on whether they want to own a community or participate in one, doing a hard look on what the goals of that community or that participation ought to be, and then trying to drive both the activity and the quality up as far as they can to make that community really work for them.
Thank you very much for being on for this podcast, Mark.
I'm happy to do it. Check out my blog at www.charmedparticles.com, and it's a physics joke, and look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
So I'm going to be linking off to his blog from the web post. So if you've listened to the podcast, it's usabilitycounts.com, and there will be a link there also to his blog. So that's about it. Thank you very much, and look forward to another podcast next week.